we've been looking at the story of Yosef from a variety of different aspects, from a variety of different perspectives. Again, it's important to recognize that like other stories in the Torah, this story unfolds on a variety of different levels at once. Okay. I'm loud enough. Okay. It's recording, but it's okay. What?
The audio
is... It's speaking on the computer, right.
Yeah.
That's fine. Okay. No, the audio... Okay, thanks. All right. So the story unfolds on a variety of different levels at once, as do all the stories in the Torah. The key issue to remember here is that the story of Yosef sets up the stage for the national era of the Jewish people. In other words, it is the transitional story between the patriarchal period and the period of the Jewish nation, with the nation being born through Yetzias Mitzrayim and through Matan Torah. One of the threads that courses beneath the surface that is easily missed is the struggle for leadership in Klal Yisrael. Who's going to emerge as the ultimate leader of the Jewish people? Now here, the leader of the Jewish people, what I mean is there are different elements of leadership. This is not the spiritual leadership as much as it is the political leadership, the monarchy. Who is going to be the head, from where will the monarchy of the Jewish nation descend? And that becomes the struggle that's going to unfold for us in today's session. And there are really three candidates that present themselves for our attention in terms of leadership within the Jewish people. And again, the monarchical leadership. And the first is the Bechor, Reuven. The second is Yosef, who I refer to as the Ish Matzliach, the one who is the successful leader politically, even within an alien culture. And the third candidate will be Yehuda, and we've put a little note by him, the journey. All right. And what I want to do is I want to look at each of these individuals, try to figure out what recommends them for leadership, why they are or are not chosen for leadership. And the story and these issues emerge as threads within the Yosef story. Let's start with the first. Let's start with the natural choice for leadership within the Jewish nation. And the natural choice for leadership, of course, is Reuven. Why the natural choice? Because he is the Bechor. Because he is the one who is the firstborn. And by definition, the Bechor is supposed to be the leader naturally. We find, however, in each of the stories of Bereishit that the Bechor loses that right. But we'll talk about that in a moment. So what do we learn about Reuven and what recommends him or disqualifies him for leadership within the Jewish nation? So let's start with what I call a prologue. And the prologue here is an event that occurs before the Yosef story, and that's why I'm calling it a prologue. It's a very, very puzzling event, and it's one that is understood widely differently by the different commentaries. The pasuk reads, "Vayhi b'shkon Yisrael ba'aretz ahu, vayelech Reuven." After the death of Rachel. Reuven, vayelech Reuven, vayishkav es Bilha pilegesh aviv. And he had relations with Bilha, his father's concubine. Vayishma Yisrael, and Israel heard, vayehi b'nei Yaakov shnei masar. And the children of Yaakov were 12. Now what automatically strikes you about this? Puzzle.
He didn't come enough to make a living.
All right. What happened with Vayu? What is the connection between that last little knip, right, at the end, Vayu, B'nei Yaakov, Shnei Masar, with what comes before? Leave it aside for a minute. We're going to come back to that. Let's focus on Reuven's actions here. So I want you to look first at the Radak, which is down the second paragraph, not the first. Look at the underlined section. Shiruven choshav ki lo haisa asura alav lifi shahaisa techila shifcha v'achar kein locha aviv lipi legesh. So the Radak is accepting the literal interpretation of the text. And what I mean by the literal interpretation of the text is that Reuven actually has relations with Bilhah. Okay, got it. Thank you. That Reuven actually has relations with Bilhah. And this is somewhat frightening. Where does this come from? What kind of action is this to do? And why is it happening? And the Radak says that Reuven was a Toa, he made a mistake. He thought that this was allowable. He thought that since she was not his wife, but his Pilegesh, but his servant, that it was okay for him to have relations with her. And because of this, if you take a look at the next underlined section, Lefichach notal mimenu Yaakov becharoso, as it says, when Yaakov later will bless his sons, he will say that Yaakov takes away Reuven's rights as a bechor because he acted improperly in this circumstance. Now the Radak is taking a direct Pashut Pshat approach to this event, which is somewhat rare among the commentaries. Because if you take a look at the first paragraph, you find a section from the Talmud Bavli where the Talmud says the following: Reuven never had relations with Bilhah. What happened was the following. He was defending what he saw as the honor of his mother. During Rachel's lifetime, Yaakov kept his bed in most prominently in Rachel's tent. When Rachel dies, Yaakov moves the bed to Bilhah's tent. Reuven says to himself, chutzpah. This is not appropriate. Who is it going to hurt? My mother. He therefore goes and moves his father's bed to Leah's tent. He does not have relations with her. In fact, if you take a look at the Gemara says, Amar Rab Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amar Rab Yochanan, Kol Omer Reuven Chota, Eino Elo Toe. Anybody who says that he actually had relations with Bilhah is making a mistake. Now this, of course, brings us once again to that spectrum you and I have encountered a number of times in our study, which is between those who are willing to understand the possible grievous error on the part of the heroes of the text, and those, like the Gemara here, who is saying couldn't have been that Reuven had relations with Bilhah. Reuven's a tzaddik, it couldn't have been. And therefore, what must it be that he was holding on to the respect and the kavod of his mother? And because this was the wrong thing to do nonetheless, because it was an action that he should not have done, he therefore, the text refers to it in a derogatory way by saying that he was shochev in Bilhah. But it didn't really happen.
How do you explain the word ishkav?
So that's why. Look, read the Gemara. All right, the Gemara says Shneamar Bayu Yaakov Bayu Bnei Yaakov Shneamos Sarmer Lamed Shekulan Shkulin Kaachas. The Gemara says the proof that of our position is that last little knipple on the pasuk which bothered us, which was why does it say Bayu Bnei Yaakov Shneamos Sarmer? What's that saying? So the Gemara says that shows that Reuven did not lose his stature as one of the sons of Yaakov. Had he really been Shochev, he would have lost that stature. Elamani Makayim Vayishkav Es Bilhah Pilegesh Aviv, which is your question. How do I understand those words. Malamed shebilbel matzao shel aviv. It means that he overturned or he confused his bed. It doesn't mean that he actually slept with her. It's not pashut pshat. Alright? It's not pashut pshat, which is why the Radak says what he says. Alright? In other words, we have here a difference of approach. But the Talmud is saying we cannot accept the possibility that Reuven would have done that. And we are finding, and as attestation to Reuven's righteousness, that last little piece of the pasuk, and therefore we have to explain it this way. Now, there is another explanation for that last piece of the pasuk, and that is the Radak says that what happened after this event, whether it was the actual event or the Radak at the end also says, by the way, the Drash says differently than I'm saying, the Yaakov stopped having children. That's the Radak. And whether he was traumatized by what happened here or he realized the politics involved in multiple wives, whatever it may be, and that's why it says Vayihu b'nei Yaakov shnei masar, point, finished. No more kids. Alright? And that's the explanation for the last part of the pasuk. Why am I bringing this event? Because there is an element here that's going to continue to unfold as we learn more about Reuven. And that is, whatever it was that happened here, there's a compulsiveness in terms of his actions. He acts necessarily, it would seem, without a great deal of thought. Particularly if you take the Talmud's point of view, that he was protecting his mother's honor, there are different ways to do that than just to go into the tent and move your father's bed. Right? There are ways to talk to your father, there are ways to deal with it, which the Talmud is painting a picture of someone who has the right motives. Right? He's protecting his mother's honor, but whose actions are lacking. Yes?
Not just compulsive, but also he tends not to confront the right person.
Right.
He didn't confront Yaakov. He doesn't confront the brother.
Okay, so we're going to go on to that. Excellent. Excellent. Excellent point, and that's going to be part of what's happening here. The word I'm looking for is not so much compulsive as
impulsive.
Right? In other words, he acts. He moves. Let's go to the next event. All right, and now we're into the Yosef story. And the next time Reuven appears as a potential leader, and for those of you who came in a little late, we're looking at candidates for leadership in the Yosef story. And when I call leadership, I mean monarchical leadership. Leadership in terms of who inherits, who eventually becomes the predecessor of monarchy. So here we have, at the pit, very clearly, Reuven emerges fairly well. Vayishma Reuven, Reuven hears what? He hears the brother saying, let's kill Yosef. Vayatzileu miyodam. And he saves him. Alright? The testimony of the text, at the bottom of the page, is he saves Yosef's life. Vayomar aleim Reuven. And he says to Reuven, Al tishbuchu dam. He says to his brothers, don't spill his blood. Hashlichu oto el habor hazeh asher bamidbar. Throw him into the pit. And then, v'yad al tishbuchu bo, and then finally the last part of the sentence, Leman hatzil oso miyadam the hoshivo el aviv. And his plan, his hope, his intention is to what? It's to do what? Right? Okay. Save it. What is strange about that last puzzle? Mm-hmm. We encountered it before. We raised it before, a long time ago. What's strange about puzzle from bed? What's the Torah doing that it rarely does? If ever?
Motivation.
What?
Motivation.
It's telling you the motivation. It's telling you what Reuven is thinking. As a rule, let's remember, as a rule, actions in the Torah speak louder than words. In fact, I would use it differently. Actions speak, words don't. What do I mean by that? The Torah does not tell you Avram runs to the angels because he wants to be machnis orchem, because he wants to welcome guests, and that's his intention, right? What the Torah does is the Torah tells you he's running to the guests, and you are to glean from that he's sitting in the middle of the day and he's waiting for guests, right? The Torah doesn't tell you what is in Avram's mind as he climbs Har Moriah to sacrifice his son. The Torah doesn't tell you what Yosef intends to do with all the machinations with the brothers. What does the Torah do? The Torah allows actions to speak for themselves. Why here does the Torah add that last phrase, Leman Hatzil Osomi Adam Lahoshiva El Aviv?
Maybe just to be very factual with what there should be no machlokes what he was doing.
Okay, all right, good. Why would there be machlokes?
He didn't want him to die.
Didn't want him to die. But the problem here is what happens next? Reuven disappears and comes back, right? So what wouldn't I know if the Torah didn't tell me? I wouldn't know what. You see, the Torah allows actions to speak because generally actions reflect motivation. The very rare times where actions don't reflect motivation, or maybe questionable in terms of motivation, which is what you were saying, the Torah wants to be clear, the Torah will then tell you the motivation. For example, and we did study. Noach ish tzadik tamim haya b'darosav. Noach was a righteous man, tamim in his generations. That's how the Torah introduces Noach. When the Torah introduces Avraham, the Torah doesn't say, "Vayomer Hashem el Avraham, ish tzadik, tamim b'darosav, lech lecha me'artzecha." Right? Because you're going to learn who Avraham was from his actions. All of Noach's actions don't necessarily reflect tzidkus, right? Go into the boat, save yourself, build a boat, come out of the boat, right? So you could learn the entire story of Noach and say, well, God chose him because he had blue eyes. Or because he liked to smile. In other words, there's nothing that will prove Noach's tzidkus from the story. Therefore, the Torah has to tell you. Same here. If you read that Reuven said, don't kill him, throw him into the pit, and then disappear, your understanding of that motivation might well have been, he didn't want to directly kill him, but he wanted to let him die. Right? So the Torah says, no, he's planning to come back to save him, because those actions don't speak for themselves. And that's the problem with Reuven, you see. Reuven here emerges again as what? Someone with great motivations. I want to save Yosef. But as you said, he doesn't turn to the brothers. He doesn't say to them, let's not kill him. He says, don't spill blood, throw him into the pit. And what do the rabbis say about this pit? As if underlying my point. They says the pit says Vahabor Reik Ein Bo Mayim. The pit is empty; it had no water. So what does it say? Why do you have to say it had no water? You're saying it's empty because it had snakes and scorpions, right? What is the Gemara saying? The Gemara is saying you were endangering his life by throwing him into the pit, right? But that's how Reuven acts. Reuven says, "I'll save him. Throw him into the pit." Do you think about that? Do you question what's going to happen when you throw him into the pit? What's going to happen when you throw him into the pit and you leave and come back and leave him with the brothers sitting around? Can you be... No thought to that. One last evidence concerning Reuven.
Can I ask
you? Yeah, sure.
Tzidkus
tzaddik means righteousness. Where does it say?
Are you using that word?
Oh, I used it, a tzaddik, that's righteousness. I used it to describe Noah. The Torah uses it to, a tzidkut is righteousness coming from the word tzaddik.
Thank you
for stopping me. Okay, now let's take a look on page 2, and I'm sorry that I didn't get a chance to translate all of these sections. We're now, yes.
Was that a compromise solution?
From his perspective?
From his perspective.
Of course it was. I mean, it was a compromise to the extent that, no, I'd say differently. From his perspective, it wasn't a compromise. He was going to save him completely. In other words, it was not. It was a way to do it without, as she said, without confrontation. In other words, it was a way to do it without necessarily confronting the brothers. Either because he feels he doesn't have the ability to, you know, to really stand up to them, or he doesn't feel, which is in and of itself a lack of leadership, as we'll see. As we'll see when we contrast it to Yehuda. Now take a look at the last piece of evidence concerning Reuven. And this is probably the most telling. The Joseph story has continued. We're now at the point where Joseph has been mind-gaming the brothers. He says to the brothers, this is after he's appointed viceroy, he's now there, they've come for food. He turns to them and says, I want you to go back and I want you to bring Binyamin back here. And he throws Shimon into jail. And he says, I won't see you again unless you bring your youngest brother with you. The brothers go back to Yaakov and they say, you're not going to believe what happened. We were accused of being spies. And we saw the second in command to the king, and he will not give us food, he will not see us, he will not talk with us unless we bring Benjamin down with us, unless we bring your youngest son. Now what does Yaakov say? Absolutely not. Right? Already you made me lose one son, now Shimon's in jail, you're going to take the only other son that I have that comes from Rachel, you're going to endanger him, why did you even tell him you had a brother? No. So Reuven stands up, and again, Reuven is the Bechor, right? And Reuven turns to Yaakov, and in the second sentence at the top of page 2 says what? Vayomer Reuven el aviv lemor. Reuven says to his father, Eshnei bonai tamis im lo avienu elecho. I'll make this deal with you. Put Binyamin in my care, and if I don't bring him back to you, you can kill my two sons. To know, so al yodiv ani yeshavenu alecha. Put him in my hand and I will bring him back to you. To which Yaakov says, what? Lo yere b'ni machem. Forget it. Now, what's going on here? Look at Yaakov. Yaakov looks at Reuven and says, are you out of your mind? What? What kind of, you know, you're telling me, give you Binyamin, if you don't bring Binyamin back, I can kill what my grandsons. So what do you see here again? Reuven is motivated by this tremendous desire to do what's right. He knows what's right. We got to go back. We got to get food. We're going to die here. But he doesn't think. He turns to a grandfather and says, kill your grandchildren if I don't bring them back. To which Yaakov says, I might ever put him in your care. Right? I'm adding some words here, but I'm assuming that that's what a grandfather would say. How can you say something like that to me? Which is why when Yaakov blesses Reuven at the end of his life, how does he describe him? Pachaz kamayim. Unstable as water. Which is fascinating, because what is the characteristic of water? The characteristic of water is that you open up the spigot and it flows, right? It seeks. It automatically seeks without any hesitation. The lowest just goes. You're unstable as water. Right? You can't be. And what happens is, and this is fascinating, There are three elements to the Bechora. There are three elements to the three rights that a firstborn has. One of them is monarchy. And as we see, he will lose that. We'll get to whom. The second right is the double portion. Right? A Bechor gets a double portion. Reuven loses that right to who?
Yosef.
Yosef, because there'll be Ephraim and Menashe. And the third right of the Bechor is the religious leadership, which he will lose ultimately to Levi. So all three elements of the Bechorah are given to others rather than Reuven. Reuven loses his rights. Now let's take a look at Yosef. All right, candidate number two. As I said, we're in the middle of an election, and we've disqualified candidate number one. Don't vote for him. Right now we're looking at candidate number two. Candidate number two has a lot to recommend. Right? Who is candidate number two on page two? Yosef, whom the Torah describes as the Ish Matzliach. We had this before, right? Who is Yosef? What is a Matzliach? What does it mean? Hatzlacha. He is the successful one. He is the one who rises to the top wherever you put him. He's top dog, right? Top dog among the brothers, top dog among the Egyptians, top dog in the jail, top dog in Potiphar's house. Wherever you put this man, he rises to the top. I'd be his campaign manager any day, right? This man is a perfect candidate for leadership, except for one thing. What's the one thing? What?
Tattletale.
He's a tattletale, right? Right. He tells stories on his brothers. What else? He never, ever becomes one with the people around him. He is always apart. Not through desire necessarily, but just something keeps him. Rav Soloveitchik calls him the puppeteer. Right? He's not part of the group. He is the one who's manipulating the group. He's taking care of things. He's doing things. And you see this because there are two groups that he could ultimately have been part of. Right? He could have been part of the brothers, and he could have been part of the Egyptians. Those are the two groups that set themselves up as potential groups in which he can be a member. Let's see what happens with the brothers. Okay, so let's look at the evidence. And here you have it in English as well as Hebrew. Brothers, right? He's a tattletale. Number one. Vayachalom Yosef chalom. Second source. He dreams a dream. Vayosifu o snow o so. The brothers what? Hate him. He tells the dreams, right? Vayachalom chadaper, and he tells it to his brothers. He doesn't learn. We said in the beginning of his life, his diplomacy is pretty poor, right? He doesn't have social cues here. He's not feeling this hatred coming. Vayikanu boachiv, they're jealous of him. Next step, take a look. Okay, so he's not part of the brothers when he lives with them in his father's house. He's the favorite, but he's separate. What about at the end? What about once he reveals himself to the brothers, viceroy of Egypt, now everything's fine, let me become part of you. What happens? So first, take a look at the last paragraph on page two. He turns to the brothers and he says, Al teyotzvu val yichar be'enehem. Don't be upset, don't be angry what you did to me. God sent me here. Remember, that's his element. He keeps bringing God into the picture. What's he doing? He's trying, and we had Rosh Hashanah Foyle Hirsch here, we learned, who said that what he was trying to do is what? With all the things he does with the brothers, is to build a new relationship, right? Don't be afraid. Don't be upset. Everything's okay. I want to be part of you. Does it work? Doesn't work. Take a look on the next page. What happens? Right? After Yaakov dies, right? The end of the story. Yaakov dies. The brothers turn around and say, "Vayiru et Yosef kimeis achei Yosef kimeis avihem." First line, second paragraph on page 3. Vayomru lu yistemenu Yosef. What's their first reaction when the father died? Yosef's going to kill us. Yosef's going to take revenge. The only reason he didn't take revenge was what? Because my father, your father was alive. And they come to Yosef and they say to him, Avicha tziva lifnei moso, your father made us promise. Kosomru li Yosef, go to Yosef and say, please forgive them. Did Yaakov ever say this? We don't know. Right? We don't know. This is one of those two places where the rabbis say, you are allowed to lie for the sake of peace. Right? That it's possible he said this, but it's very possible that Yaakov never said this, and what are the brothers doing? They're making up a story. Because they're trying to make peace between. So here you have, they've lived for 18 years together, right? Yaakov lives 18 years in Egypt. During those 18 years, Yosef has manipulated the first ghetto. His brothers are living in Goshen. They're succeeding. He's taken care of them for 18 years. What's the first thing they think once Yaakov dies? He's going to kill us. So all that Yosef has done to repair that relationship, all that Yosef has done to make things better, it's like it didn't happen. Which makes the next statement very poignant. Vayishava, at the end of Sefer Bereishis, what does Yosef turn to his brothers and say? Pakod yifkod Elohim eschem, va'alisem etzatz mosai mizeh. He says to them, God's going to remember you one day, and he's going to take you out of Egypt. And please, when God does that, take me with you. Now, he doesn't do what Yaakov did, which was what? Said, bury me now in Israel. All right? Maybe because he can't. Right? Those of us, we might remember that's a very dangerous thing, and that Yosef had to manipulate it to get Yaakov to be buried in Israel. Nobody's around to handle it for Yosef. But another answer is, he's turning to the brothers, and what's he saying to them? At least after death, let me be one of you. Right? So Yosef emerges with the brothers as a lonely figure. Someone who has never fully trusted. Someone who has never fully accepted for all the leadership that he's done. What about the Egyptians? Does he ever become one with the Egyptian people who he's leading? And so here we have a variety of sources, but I took what I think was the most telling. You might remember it. We learned it. When Yosef comes, brings the brothers back the first time, he's now second in command, and the first thing that he does is he makes a feast for them. And eating at this feast are Yosef, the Egyptians, and the brothers. Right? Feast. And what does this Torah say? Vayasimu lo levado, v'lohem levadom, v'lametzrim ha'ochlim oso levadom. What does he do? I said this is the first example of separate seating at a Jewish event. Right? The Mitzrim set up a place for Yosef alone. They set up places for the Ivrim alone, right? The Hebrews. And they set up a place for the Egyptians alone. Why? Torah tells us. Ki lo yuchluna mitzrim lechol es ho'ivrim lechem ki to'evanu l'mitzrayim. Because the Egyptians refuse to break bread with the Hebrews because it's an abomination. So they're refusing to break bread with the brothers, but who else are they refusing to break bread with? With Yosef. Yosef's a Hebrew. Right? Yosef sits alone. This is one of the saddest psukim in the Torah. After everything this man has done, right, to save Egypt, what does he do? He's sitting alone.
Why were they, whoever the Jews are, abominable to them?
Why? For the same reason we're abominable to people today. You know what? If anyone can tell me the root causes of anti-Semitism, there are a variety. But I think the answer, even back then, well, you didn't have Christianity, so it didn't come from the Christians. They were strangers. They were different. They were alien. We don't want strangers. We're always the strangers within any society, and that's what's happening here. The Egyptians will not break bread with us. That comes later. In other words, that aspect of it is underscored later. It could be. I mean, in other words, when Yosef manipulates the brother's descent and the descent of his family, he tells them, tell them you're cattle herders because they hate cattle herders and they'll keep you separate. And then he orchestrates the first ghetto. But it's not clear that that's the reason here. It could just be that, you know, We don't break bread with them. They're different. They're strange. The Torah doesn't tell us.
Will Yosef eat with the Egyptians?
It says, would Yosef eat with the Egyptians of his own volition? That's a good question. It doesn't say that Yosef wouldn't. Right? I mean, first of all, let's remember, there are no, there's nothing kosher today at this point. Torah hasn't been given yet. So the laws of kashrut officially don't apply. So he can eat whatever he wants. Although, again, there is a rabbinic tradition that they kept the Torah, but literally that may not push a shot. There are no mitzvot at this point. So would he eat with Egyptians? Doesn't say he wouldn't. They just don't give him a chance.
But it doesn't say he would because
no. But there's
wine.
Again, you're making an assumption, which is a literal interpretation of a medrashic approach, that at this point all the laws that we now observe were being kept then. On a pashut shot level, none of those laws emerge until later in death. Certainly not drinking wine. Drinking wine is a rabbinic law which comes much later. So from Yosef's position, now what we end up seeing is that Yosef orchestrates the separateness of his brothers when they come down. And that may be because he feels he was never accepted and he knows the cost at trying. But the fact is that the Torah says the reason he's not eating with the Egyptians here is because the Egyptians don't want to eat with him. Yes?
Could you say that the Egyptians were neurotic about that? That's why they abominated the...
Could I say they were neurotic? I don't know enough about them to say that they're neurotic. You want to call anti-Semitism a neurosis?
Yeah.
then the whole world is neurotic. It's frightening. I mean, it's frightening. I mean, you read the articles today and look what happened in the Chabad. Where does this... Deborah Lipstadt, I just read something today where Deborah Lipstadt says anti-Semitism is like a virus, which is constantly there. It just remains under the surface and has the ability to proliferate, she points out, in almost any setting. If you're with the conservatives, then the Jews are too liberal. If you're with the liberals, the Jews are too conservative. No matter what it is, whoever it is, they're capitalists, they're communists. It really doesn't matter. It just proliferates. Yes?
Jean-Paul Sartre wrote once that if the Jew did not exist,
we'd have to invent him. Right.
Add online to that might be that for whatever reason the Rabbi Shalom had it in mind that we are the chosen people in more than one way.
It's a frightening thing to think. Look, the conscience of the world on some level is what we've been called, and people don't like that.
I have this thing that I feel like people need a scapegoat. That's a psychological
thing. Mm-hmm.
And
we're the natural ones.
Yeah.
Then yeah, we're again, we're always a we insist on being, you know, but look at it again both ways. We insist on being different, and yet when we try to be like them, they hate us even more, right? So there is, we pointed this out at Purim time. Amalek is irrational. The hatred of the anti-Semite is an irrational hatred. We could sit here and we could try to analyze it. We could call it a neurosis. We could call it a psychosis. We could call it whatever we want. It's irrational. It's irrational. And unfortunately, until the end of time, will apparently not be eradicated. As we pointed out, we had a bubble. We lived in a bubble following World War II. For a series of years, it was unfashionable to be an anti-Semite, right? So that was that, and you know, and we started feeling, because the Holocaust occurred, it'll be different, it'll change. And no, it was just a bubble, and the bubble has burst. All right. Anyway, we're a little off track. We got to get to our. We got to find out the result of our election here. So, the point is, we've just disqualified two candidates. So now you know the results. But let's see why. We're looking at Yehuda. Okay, Yehuda. Yehuda is not the firstborn. Yehuda is not, in the story, originally a hero. Let's see. Yehuda's first major role emerges on page 3 at the bottom at the pit. Right? He turns to his brothers. And he says, literally, and here you use the word compromise. Here he uses the word compromise, but a little bit differently. The word betza comes from the word bitsua, which means compromise or benefit. It could be used for two different. It says, "Ma betza kinaro gesachinu." What gain will we have if we kill our brother? Right? Where is this happening? The brothers in the pit. Yosef's in the pit. Reuven's disappeared. The brothers are sitting down and eating. And Yehuda says, "Whoa, look at that! I see a caravan coming. What benefit?" And this is cold. It's calculating. Right, isn't it? It's not a great honor. You know, what benefit? You know, let's you know, if we're gonna kill him or if we're gonna do something to him, let's at least what? Let's make some money out of the deal. Right? But there is one thing that happens here that does recommend him for leadership. And that is that he convinces the brothers. Right? He is honest about his intention, and the brothers listen. They listen. So there is an element of natural leadership here that is absent with Reuven. Right? Reuven doesn't confront. Reuven doesn't tell the truth. He says, I'll find a way to manipulate this so the brothers won't know what I'm doing. Let's throw him into the pit. Judah says, this is what we should do, and the brothers listen. Wow. Okay, that's something already. Turn the page. The next thing that happens in the Torah is fascinating. Because the next thing that happens in the Torah is in the middle of the Joseph story, another story is inserted. In the middle. Right? Right after the sale of Yosef. And that story is introduced with the following sentence. This is right after Joseph is sold and they come back and they tell the father that he's dead. The next chapter begins, Vayered Yehuda me'es echav. What did Yehuda do? He separated himself from his brothers. What does that seem to indicate? What does that seem to indicate? He can't live with what happened. Right? In other words, well, we did this, but life doesn't go on normally. I can't live with these brothers with whom I did this. He separates. And what does he do? He goes to an Ish Adulami, an Adulamite by the name of Chira, and he marries the daughter of Chira, and he has children. And his oldest son marries a woman by the name of Tamar. And his oldest son sins and dies. And apparently, even before the giving of the Torah, there was a concept of levirate marriage already, which is if a son dies without having children, So she marries his second son. And he dies. So what's supposed to happen? She's supposed to marry his third son. Again, that this story is right in the middle of nowhere. Right? Right in the middle of the Yosef story. And what does he do? He refuses to let her marry Shelah. Because he says she's a black widow. She marries somebody and he dies. Yeah, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to endanger my youngest son.
He was too young.
Doesn't say that. He refuses to let her marry him because he's afraid she's going to die. And Shelah grows up and he still doesn't let her marry him. He ignores her. He lets her be and she never marries. And then what happens? One day he's out and Tamar hears that he's in the area. And what does she do? She dresses up as a concubine. She seduces him. He says, I have no money to give you. She says, okay, then give me something that will identify you so you can come collect your money. You know, and then you'll come collect this and give me my money. And she takes his staff and signet ring. He then goes home. He then sends someone to pay her. What happens? No. She disappears. She puts on her regular clothes and she disappears. He then hears that she's pregnant. He then, what? Says, she was supposed to marry, it's adultery for her to marry anyone else. So take her out and burn her. To which she responds, what? Whose signet ring is, who's this stuff? This is the guy to whom I'm pregnant. And she produces what? Yehuda's, take a look at what happens. Take a look at the second sentence on page 4. Vayaker Yehuda, Vayomer, Sadka Mimeni. I'm wrong. She's right. Why is this story here? Why is it at this point in the Torah? Not just because it's chronological. Because this is the turning point in Yehuda's journey. This is where his journey towards leadership really begins. He saw what happened with the brothers. He recognizes morality. He recognizes the immorality of what he did. He can't live with what happened. He separates himself. And when a moral event presents itself, what does he do? He steps up. He could have said, I don't know whose signet ring that is. There was nothing that she had no, there's no proof. The only proof there is that he recognizes it and he says, I admit that I was wrong, she is right. Wow. And what he does is he allows her to live and he never again has relations with her and she gives birth to twins and one of those twins becomes an important part of this legacy.
He never marries her.
He doesn't marry her. He just basically allows her to live as part of the family. What then goes on? So now Yehuda's begun a journey. Take a look at the next.
Did they move to Egypt with did Tamar go to Egypt with the brothers or with the family?
It would seem she becomes part of the family. As far as I have to check that, but as far as
one of the 70s, you see
that. Yeah, I have to find that out. I have to find out what happens there. But her son becomes the progenitor of Boaz, who becomes the progenitor of David. So she's certainly part of the Jewish people. I'll have to look at what happens there exactly. What happens next? Yehuda then appears again in the story. Yehuda's back with the brothers now. He comes back after that event. The Torah doesn't quite say, but he's back with the family now. And now it's time for Yehuda for again, we're back in that same scene where Yaakov is saying, don't let Binyamin go down to Egypt. Don't let him go down. And Reuven said, kill my two sons if I don't bring them back. What does Yehuda say? Look at Yehuda's words. Vayomer Yehuda Yisrael Aviv. Shilcha Nariti. Send the boy with me and we'll go. Anochi Ervenu Miyodai Tivakshenu. I will be responsible for him. From my hand will you demand him. He doesn't say, kill my kids. What does he say? I take responsibility. If I don't bring him back, then I will have sinned to you all my life. This is a man saying, I'm taking. And what word does he introduce into the Jewish lexicon? The concept of ervenu. The word ayin resh bet. I've told you this before. Always means something very specific in whatever context it's used. It means a mixture, or a combination, or an intertwining. The word ayin resh bet, erev. What is erev? It's a mixture of day and night. What is an eruv that we build in a community? It is a combination of homes, and we create a community. What is the word ta'arovet? Ta'arovet in cooking means a mixture. Right? The word erev, the word arov. What was the plague of arov? A combination of wild beasts. What does it mean when we say, call Yisrael arev in zebazeh? It doesn't mean just we're responsible for each other. It means our souls are intertwined. We are inseparable. Anochi ervenu. I am intertwined with him. Look at what he says to Yosef. When Yosef, in the last paragraph on page 4, when he stands in front of Yosef and he says, take a look at sentence 32-33. Ki avdecho orav es hanar. He says, you're not going to keep him here and let us go. I'm intertwined with that boy. We'll stay. Put me in jail. Let him go. What's happened? Yehuda's journey to leadership is complete. He's back at the same place, and instead of saying, let's send him to the Egyptians, let him stay here, we'll go, he's saying, what? It's on my head. It's on my head. That is the quality of leadership. The honesty to admit responsibility and error, and the honesty to what? To take responsibility in the face of danger to another. Those are the qualities that raise Yehuda to leadership. And well, where will monarchy come from? Not from Reuven, not from Yosef. It will come from Yehuda. And that's the end of our election. Yes?